You know, it's loose, so it's kind of. I'm sleeping, so. Okay, yeah, loose, so it's kind of. So, so the tightness grade propagation interaction of four wetlands in networks,
framed or unframed case. So here's the outline. So after motivations and introductions, and then I will talk about the operations we can do on the four wetlands spin networks. And then, equipped with these operations, we can do braid interactions and broad braid propagation. So, and at the end is the conclusions and future works. So let's start with the motivation. So as we know, loop-form gravity has been considered as a quantum theory of gravity, and which is of course very beautiful if we consider the discretized space-time, the fundamental space-time. However, it has some flaw. It doesn't have matter encoded in the theory. And people actually hadn't really thought about that loop-form gravity can be actually a kind of unified theory of gravity and matter for a long while. Until recently, some people had some discoveries, and I'll talk about that. So this is kind of a drawback, maybe shortcomings, compared to string theory, which claims that it is a theory of everything. So let's see, how can we put matter in the theory? So there are actually two kind of philosophies to unify gravity and the matter. The first one is coupling gravity with matter. So basically, you just put the write down the actions of gravity and actions of the matter part separately, and then you add them together. If there's an interaction term, you add the interaction term. So, however, there's another philosophy which says the matter may just kind of emergent effect from the more fundamental gravity. So, and this is the one we are taking in this research.
Third possibility, 5,000 is on this one.
Third possibility?
Yeah.
All right.
So in general relativity, you have the stress energy sensor T which encodes
the matter degrees of freedom. Yeah, but you need to write down the action for that.
So that's general relativity. And if you do loop quantum gravity, you usually just have the gravitational sector in the sense that you're working with factor space times and TVU is explicitly set to zero before you do the quantization. So the third possibility is turning back TVU on.
What does it mean?
Before you do the loop quantum.
Yeah, but turn TVU on means what? Means but you still need an action for that part, right?
Right, but the matter degrees of freedom would not arise from the gravitational degrees of freedom. It would simply be from the stress energy tensor. But I think that's the first option.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, no, that's coupling matter because quantum gravity is, yeah, I suppose so. You put back in like
well,
the
molecule
of Lagrangian, so.
Joel,
every
matter transfer to right balance automatically involves the matter transfer to right balance on transfer.
Right, so it's
human and gray, so it's coupled to gravity, which is kind of the first part.
Okay.
That's fine. Okay. So, where did this start? So 2 years ago, 2005, Sundance had a paper. He actually kind of modified the Freon model into a kind of ribbonized version. So in that modified model, he considered all the fundamental particles actually composed of kind of fundamental braids, three-strand braids. And this kind of shed light on our approach of loop-form gravity with matter. So I'll talk about this in more detail later. So in light of Sundance's Freon model, so people work on Lise Molin, Fatini, and the Sundance, they work on the trivalent case of the spin network. And found some kind of particle-like excitations, which might be considered or interpreted as matter particles. So, and then in this research, we're going to look at the four-bound spin networks, which come out of the spin-fold model naturally, and it actually represents the two free states. So here are the motivations.
So what's the status of Sundance's model?
Status, here trying to list all the, how to say, the fundamental particles. Okay.
But he's in terms of the, he's still in three-way.
Yeah, he's still on three-way.
So can't you say that the new research which shows that it's four-built spin networks which are relevant sort of excludes Sundance's model?
What do you mean by excludes?
Since his model is exclusively three-way. But if the four valence, that's more appropriate.
Well, according to my understanding, first of all, four elements, each of the vertices of four elements spin network corresponds to three states, right?
It has his building blocks are.
But you can consider things in this way, because in spin networks, if spin networks is decorated with SU2 or SU3 implementations, these four elements spin networks can be composed into basis of traveling spin networks. So
the reason you say that four valence spin networks have a true correspondence is because the volume is zero for the three valence ones, or is it?
Yeah.
So if you split your four valence into three valence, you have a problem.
We found out a possible decomposition, and we can interpret all the four element nodes in terms of the trivalent nodes, which look like the four element. That's not currently included in this part of the research. So how does a embedded four element spin network look like? So here's an example. So we have vertices and edges. This is very simplified example. Now, if the spin network is framed, then all these edges may be considered as tubes. So then, how do we notate this kind of embedded spin networks mathematically? So this can be done in terms of spheres and tubes. So locally, each of the vertex could be actually considered
dual to a tetrahedron, which has four faces, and each of the nodes can be represented by a sphere, and all the four edges are represented by these tubes. Each of the tube is dual to a face of a tetrahedron locally. But this is still a complicated version of the notation. We can further simplify this simplify the sphere into just a circle, and these tubes into lines. Because we know that these represent tubes. In the unframed case, the sphere still stays, but the lines are real lines, not tubes anymore. So, and there is a kind of very obvious symmetry here, because of the local duality. If we just choose one of the edges as a rotation axis, equivalently, we can consider we fix one of the four faces of this tetrahedron. Then the other three faces has a rotation symmetry. If we rotate a thing with respect, for example, if we take B with respect to B by a 2π/3, then the tetrahedron will look like this, exactly the same to us, because all the other three faces are still on an equal footing. So we can just choose any of these four edges of a node as a rotation axis. And in the framed case, there could be twists on the edges, so we can also label the twist. This is a temporary notation of the twist. I will show you a better notation later. So, and now with for an embedded four spin networks, there is a special type of topological structures can emerge on these embedded spin networks. They are actually braids. So here's an example of the braids. So a braid, in our context, is formed by the three common edges of two adjacent nodes, this one and that one. And it has two external edges, which means each of these two nodes still has one free edge, goes to somewhere else in the spin network. And what we need is whatever captured between these two nodes satisfies the ordinary definition of a braid in the braid theory. And we could have twists on these edges in the framed case. But this is actually not a Newfoundland because, sorry.
Could you at some point say sort of more very basically the spin network is?
It might be helpful if you describe what you're actually braiding to help answer the question.
What we're actually braiding are the edges of the spin network.
Yeah,
embedded in some of three men.
Can you relate what you're braiding to the final excitations of the field you're quantizing? Because the spin net state is related to quantization.
So you can consider, well, each of the edges actually corresponds to or represent a area, right? For surface in three.
They only represent an area after you use the area operator on your state. So instead of in terms of an observable like area, think in terms of states and the actual excitations. Okay, because if you're thinking in terms of area, then you've made a measurement and you don't really have anything to work with it. So it's before you make a measurement that you've got this. You've got your state space, which is in Newfoundland, it's a polymer state space. And so you can sort of imagine that the fundamental excitations aren't described by a continuous state, but something more polymer-like. And so when you do the quantization, you find natural variables related to how long these are going to occur. And so what these actual edges are parts of the polarities, the actual polymer representation of your state space. And the brain as if you can do that.
Well, I guess you could say that. I don't know how to make that more visible, but it's just
well,
slower
it's
enough.
Right, so if you haven't seen anything with quantum gravity, you don't know
what to do. If I may, I think it's much simpler than that. In superconductors, there's quantization of magnetic flux, and there are quantized magnetic flux lines, and it's believed that in QCD, there's quantization of electric flux, and there are quantized flux lines. And in quantum gravity, there is definitely quantization of electric flux. And these are field lines of quantized electric flux, and they can be braided. And there's dynamics by which there are networks of lines of quantized electric flux. They interact with nodes, and the dynamics which you will come to. So it's not, you don't have to say complicated things about polymers or holonomies or anything. It's just quantized electric flux lines.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. So, yeah, actually, more than 100 years ago, Lord Kelvin, he actually kind of proposed a theory for the atoms. He thought all the atoms are actually knots in the ether. But that theory dies very quickly because there are many problems. The first main major problem is that all those knots or links here are so stable that there's no way to make them interact with each other. We can't put two knots together to form another knot. There's no such a mechanism to make that happen. And second, a major problem is that there are too many these knots and links. And how could they correspond to the atoms? Because we have so few possible atoms. So there are two major problems of that very, very old theory, primordial theory. So, but now this is kind of revival of the that kind of original thinking, I think. So now the next step, since we have these twists and crossings of these braids, now to make a further calculation easier, we can represent these truths and teach these truths in a better way, more algebraically, we can actually assign a number to all the right-handed truths, a positive number to the right-handed truths, and a negative number to all the left-handed truths. And the truths are in the unit of pi over 3. Why is in the unit of pi over 3? There are two reasons. The first reason is that for a tube, in the frame case, for a tube, pi over 3 is the minimal distinguishable truth of a piece of tube embedded in 3D. The second reason will be clear in the next couple of slides. So we can also assign a number to these crossings, also according to their handedness. So these kind of crossing, we call it right-handed, we assign +1 to it, and these are -1s. And if there's no crossing, it's of course 0. So now let's talk about the equivalence moves we can do on these embedded spin networks. Because when we really draw embedded spin network, we actually draw it on a piece of paper, which is 2D surface. So there are many projections actually correspond to the same embedded graph in 3D. Right? So these projections are equivalent to each other. So there must be a way to relate them. So these are actually, so we're not talking about these equivalence moves which relate one of the projections to its equivalent projections of the same embedded graph. So the first type of equivalence moves are rotations. As I just mentioned in the slide of the notation, there is a symmetry of the nodes. If we choose one of the four edges of the node as the rotation axis, we can rotate the other. We can rotate the node with respect to that axis, right? And it still represents the same thing. So, and we can do the 2 pi over 3 rotations. We can also do the pi rotations. So the actually generators of all the rotations are pi over 3 rotations. This is actually the second reason why we put the twist in the unit of pi over 3. So let's take a look at an example. So this is a node with four edges. So these the edges A and C are in the front, and B and Z are in the back in this projection. And if we choose the axis Z as the rotation axis, we can do, for example, we can do a pi over 3 rotation with respect to this axis. And these red dots are connected somewhere. We can consider that they are fixed. So after this rotation, all these four edges of the node gain the same amount of twist, but the one on the rotation axis, the sign is different from the other three on the other of the other three edges. We can also rotate this node in another direction. So this was the previous example. So if we rotate it in the other direction with respect to the same axis, we got a similar picture, but the crossing becomes in the lower part of the graph. And we also, the edges also gained twists. So in this case, we consider edges A and C are to the front. And we can also consider the case where the edges A and C are in the back of the projection. So we can also do a similar rotations. These are the results. So apart from rotations, we can also do translations. As we know, for embedded 3 graph, we have a kind of translations. That's the so-called Reitmeister moves. But Reitmeister moves are moves only about the edges without involving the vertices of the graph. So in this case, in our situation, we can consider translating the nodes of a graph. So this is the simplest case. So these red dots also represents somewhere else in the graph.
we just consider that they are fixed. And we can translate. There's no difference between this graph and this graph if we put this node, translate this node to the left, okay, but with these points fixed. And the more, a little bit more complicated cases where there is a crossing. So in this case, we have a node and we have a crossing, but you see that the edges of this node, X, are above, or are always above this edge, E. So we can safely just translate this node to the other side of the crossing. The crossing still stays the same, right? And we create a crossing here, but we actually annihilated the crossing here. So these two pieces of the graph are equivalent to each other. Now, if the rotations and these translations are indeed equivalence moves of these projections, then there should be a kind of conserved quantity, right? So now, what is the conserved quantity? So conserved quantity can be defined in such a way. It's called we call it an effective twist. So for any subdiagram, so just consider any subdiagram of an embedded four-valent spin network in 3D. So we can define the effective twist theta in terms of the sum over the twist number on all the edges of the diagram of the subdiagram minus twice of the sum of all the values of the crossings in the subdiagram. And this quantity is indeed preserved by all the equivalence moves, if you check them carefully. So this means those moves are very well defined equivalence moves, which relates all the equivalent embeddings. Equivalent projections of the same embedded spin network. Show example.
Can you consider an equivalence move related to boosts? What? So I know that you have a quantized spatial surface and time is explicitly missing from this picture, but I'd like to think special optimistically. And so I can see here you have rotations and translations, so I'm going to have
to. Hold on, this is a graph embedded in a 3D spatial. Okay,
so that's why I asked
the question. So if you can see the time, that's not equivalence move anymore, that's evolution. So I'm going to show you
so
evolution.
So you do not expect these quantities to be considered under things like boosts. So your grading would not be considered under boosts?
Well, no. I think the Lorentz symmetry doesn't exist. Well, I mean, isn't the spatial symmetry there anymore anyway because it's time to do integration in quantization?
Yeah, I guess so. But it seems like this conservation is enforced in order to make sense of these gradients so that the gradients remain the same under rotations.
Yes,
they
were
flat electron. The gradients were same. The gradient remains the same in our translation, so it's trapped an electron, you're left an electron. And when you boost an electron, you end up with an electron.
No, don't think about electrons. Okay. These are abstract graphs for the moment. Okay. We are considering if there's any conserved quantity which is preserved between all the equivalent projections of a graph embedded in some free manifold. All these operations are down on the projections without the evolution. This is no evolution yet. There's no evolution. So I'll bring up evolution soon, if you really want to think about time.
Yeah, I do, but certainly anything that changes, including rotation or terms of the translation, are things which are evolving in time. And so if you have a rotation, it means that there's an initial time and a final time, and something has actually changed. Otherwise, the translation is trivial. But I also appreciate that your graph is simply a spatial thing. And so the thing I was looking for was that it's true that rotation, translations, and boosts would keep the rating coherent, but you don't have any way to look into whose second mole. Is that a correct assessment? That you could look into whose if you have it?
I don't think these, well, I don't think these rotations
translations do correspond to the rotation translations you meant in the, you know, actually in the relativity case. Okay, there is no such correspondence yet, I don't think so. These are just
operations relating to projections. You don't really need a time to do the rotation. Well, that's my answer. You may not be right. What do you think?
Go on.
Okay, yeah. So now, with the help of these equivalence moves, then we can actually classify all the grades into two categories. The first one is reducible, the other one is irreducible. So now let's take a look what does it mean. So for example, here is a two crossing grade in this specific projection. Okay? A node on the left and a node on the right, and two crosses here. So now we can do a rotation of the right end node of this grade with respect to the external edge z. Okay? We can do the rotation in this way.
And it'll actually annihilate one of the crosses, actually the crossing at the bottom, and changes it to another braid with only one crossing, but with twists on these four edges. Now, because this move is an equivalence move, so these two braids are actually equivalent to each other. In this case, we call this braid is reducible because it can be reduced to a braid with less number of crossings, with fewer crossings. And it is also called a right reducible because we can only do the equivalence move on the right end node of this braid. So a left irreducible is defined in a similar way. And this braid you can do the rotation of this node in the opposite direction and brings it back to this braid with two crossings. And these two braids are actually in two different projections, but they are equivalent to each other. They are the same. They correspond to the same diagram, the same four-band speed network embedded in some three manifold. So now we can start to talk about the evolution moves. So because now we have these braids, and what can we do with these braids? If we don't have evolution, then we will end up with the same fate as what Lord Kelvin proposed 100 years ago. So now we can think about the evolution moves. The first one, these evolution moves can be actually considered dual to the Pachner moves of triangulations, but very locally. Okay, oh, sorry. So here's the case of 2-3 move. If we have two nodes adjacent to each other with only one and only one common edge, we can do a 2-3 move and bring it into such a configuration.
Well, it's very similar to the evolution moves of the four-band spin networks in the afferent case.
Newcomb
gravity 1-4 move.
What's the difference?
The difference is this one this one's framed.
Okay.
So because it's framed, we have
so these are just the evolution moves from right taken from the quantum gravity first.
Yeah, or you can consider that they are Pachner moves. due to the vector moves of triangulations. So this is a 2 to 3 move, and so we can do a 2 to 2 move back to the original setup. And because of the translations, we can put this guy in such a direction, and they actually go into each other.
Can you maybe explain
what
the vector moves
are? So in terms of triangulations, vector moves, there are two types of vector moves in 3D. So if you have a tetrahedron, then you can split the tetrahedron into four new tetrahedrons from its variable center. So you just use this line, these four lines to cut the tetrahedron into four new tetrahedrons. Four new tetrahedra. And the outcome is also a triangulation of the same manifold. And you can also cut, this is the 1 to 4, and you can also cut transform two tetrahedron to two tetrahedra into three new tetrahedra. So you can connect these two vertices going through their common face, and then you connect this point to the vertices of this common triangle, and then you obtain three new tetrahedra. And this is also a triangulation of the same manifold. So basically, these pattern moves, they relate all the triangulations of the same manifold. So here's the 2 to 3 move. And we also have, like here, we also have the 1 to 4 moves. So you split one tetrahedron into four tetrahedra from its barycenter. And in terms of our notation, we split one vertex into four vertices. And some new edges, the red ones, are generated during this evolution. So now with these evolution moves and those equivalence moves, we can start to look at the propagation and interactions of these braids. So here's an example of a so-called active right interaction. I will explain what does it mean by active right interaction.
Is there anything which tells you that they can't be kind of completely not attached, those links, when you do the
move? Sorry, I didn't get it. But
I mean, does the move have some rule kind of, it needs to be, those nodes need to be trivially connected, or?
Need to be, how connected?
Trivially connected. I mean, otherwise you could, not them already when you do the move.
Maybe
my question
is, the question is, what is there a unique topology for the result of the 1 to 4 rule, and is there a rule?
Yeah, the result is unique according to these splitting of the tetrahedron. But in terms of projections, you have many different projections. Because this is just one of the projections you can draw.
Okay, but so you have the rule, you split up the tetrahedron exactly that way, and that.
Yeah, right.
And of the smallest.
Then you can use the equivalence moves to transform it into another different projection, but they equivalent to each other. So let's take a look at an example. So here are two braids, one on the a braid B on the left, and some arbitrary braid B prime on the right. So we don't need to care about the proxims of this braid. Okay, this is in this case,
this braid is called inactive this braid is called active because all the subsequent moves or operations will be done within this braid. And now what we can do is we can first do a 2-to-3 move of the two nodes X and Y, which will bring you a triangle of three new vertices. And then we can use the translation moves to translate all the three newly generated nodes to the left of this crossing, to the left of this braid. And then we end up with four nodes on the other side. And then we can use the equivalence moves to put the four nodes into such a configuration or an equivalent one, so that we can do a 4-to-1 collapse move to bring you back a single node. In this way, we can put the, after these operations, the two braids can form actually a single braid, which looks like a kind of direct sum of the original two braids, just taken out the two nodes. Because the original crossing of braid B and all the crossings of this braid B prime stays after the interaction, after all these operations. And the initial twist on the braid B on this edge C is also preserved after this interaction. And because this twist is and these crossings are individually preserved, the previously defined effective twist number will also be preserved under this interaction. So because all the moves are down with respect to this braid B, so this braid B is called an active braid, which right interact onto an inactive braid B prime. So that's why it's called an active braid in action. And so apart from interactions, we still need propagations because these braids, they won't just stay there and interact with each other, right? They should come to each other first, and then you can interact.
Do you understand, or no, you're not me, but do people understand the amplitudes for these moves to happen?
Yeah, that's a good question.
We actually had a very rough proposal about how to calculate the amplitudes. I think Professor Lee Smolin had ever mentioned that in his talk, in the international telephone talk a couple of months ago.
Is that there are different spin foam models which, in which, first of all, there are labels on these edges, which are spins, and which the amplitudes are functions of labels for the given type of move. And so in a given spin foam model, say the Barre-Crane model or the Rubinstein-Barrons, et cetera, model, there are particular amplitudes for these moves. But we don't have to show them, because what we're showing is the existence of interactions, stability of the braids and interaction, propagation of the braids, which are true generally. But if one wanted to actually compute amplitudes in the real thing, one would just add the labels and do so.
Yeah, if we have a specific model, you can just calculate the
So there's some amplitude for that which we go down at some point, and it's, you know, it's a big string of 10J and 6J symbols and so forth.
But it'd still be interesting to know how likely this is to happen compared to something else, some other process. Like,
sure.
It might not be as pretty as this thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, if you're interested, I can show you how we make calculations.
So now we can have a look at the propagations. How many times did they have?
We start 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's enough. Right. So, yeah, let's talk about the propagation. We also we still talk about the right propagation because the left ones are very just similar. So here's the setup. We have a braid. for example, two crossing breaks on the left, and some kind of unknown structure on the right. And this, we have some requirements on the structure. The structure has two substructures, S and S prime, which are connected by a node Y. Okay. And this structure has an external edge goes to somewhere else in the spin network, and we don't care where it is, where it goes to. So now what we're going to show is that after
a couple of equivalence moves and evolution moves, this braid can move completely to the right of this unknown structure. We don't need to care about what precisely S and S primes are. So the first step is also the same as what we do with the interactions. We do a 2-to-3 move of these nodes X and Y first. And then we translate part of the structure generated by this 2-to-3 move to the left of within the braid B. We can pass all the crossings. Okay? And then at the end, we have three nodes. After the translation, we have three nodes on this side. And then we do a 3-to-2 move and obtain two nodes. By that, we can completely move this braid B to the right side of this unknown structure. And all these initial twists of this braid B are preserved under all these moves. And but the effective twist is not preserved so obviously, because we have some twists generated on these edges S and S prime. However, this is not a problem, because if in our case S and S prime are not connected to each other, then the twists on these S and S prime can be simply relaxed, and or you can create some more twists on these edges to have the effective twist number preserved. So this realizes the right propagation of a braid B to the right of some unknown structure. That's why this is called the right propagation. In the opposite case, we can actually move this guy to the other side. Then we got a left propagation.
Now we are coming to the theorems. So here are some theorems constraining the results. The first, if you still remember
our definition of reducibility and irreducibility, then let's forget about whatever in the parentheses. So a right irreducible braid, which means a braid that is not reducible by any equivalence moves, rotations on the right end node of that braid. Such kind of braid is not actively right interacting, which means it cannot right interact onto a braid on its right side. But it can still interact with something on its left. It may. So, and if a braid is totally irreducible, which means the braid is actually kind of fixed, you're never able to reduce the number of crossings of the braid. For such a braid, it's never actively interacting. It can only stay there as an inactive braid and wait some other braid to come up to him to it and interact with it. And for propagations, we have similar theorems. A right irreducible braid is not right propagating. So if we go back to this example, if this braid is not right reducible, which means if there's no equivalence moves can be done on this node, on the right node of this braid, which that can reduce the number of crossings of this braid, then this braid can never go to the right of such a structure. So, and if the braid is irreducible on either side, then it is never propagating it can only stay fixed on the embedded spin network. And there's another theorem which states that if a braid is actively interacting, is actively right interacting, then the braid can also propagate to the right. If it is left actively interacting, then it can also propagate to its left in the on the graph. But not vice versa, which means if a braid is propagating, is right propagating, for example, it doesn't mean it can actively interacting. So in this direction, it's not right in general. It's not true in general. So here are the conclusions. So we studied the three-strand braids excitations on the embedded four spin networks, and both of the frame and non-frame case. And we classified the braids into two major categories, and they are actually more detailed classifications. If you're interested, you can read our papers coming soon. And there we showed examples of the braid that can propagate and that can interact. And these propagations are actually chiral, because some of the braids can only propagate to its right side, some of the braids can only propagate to its left. And also, an active interaction also implies the propagation in the same direction. Well, they could be fermions, the chiral fermions. They could be chiral fermions, if you want. Yeah, it's like, you know, the chiral fermions. But so far, we don't have such a direct correspondence between these excitations and particles yet.
Why is there a left and a right in terms of like electron? So if I'm just thinking of something propagating, I don't think of left propagation or right propagation.
Well, this is the left and right. It's just a way of saying such a chiral phenomena. Okay, if a braid is left or irreducible, then you may say it's up or irreducible down.
Well, all of your pictures.
You can always align. You know.
They always look aligned, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can always,
yeah, so you can always align it that way.
Yeah. That's what I said. Well, what I mean. Okay, so here's some future works we see down. So most importantly, we should find out the true physical correspondence of these brain excitations, what they really are. We may just directly recover Sundin's prion model to interpret these braids as those fundamental particles, first generation, second generation, third generations. But this might not be done in such a framework. It can they could completely correspond to something else, maybe something more fundamental. May not be just the standard model particles. So this is something definitely needs to be done. Otherwise, we just did some mathematical work. So we have physical correspondence. But
before this actually very ambitious goal, there could be a very direct application of these braid excitations. If you have seen Mohammed's work on the black hole spectroscopy and the entanglement entropy stuff. Okay, in his work, everything is kinematic. There's no dynamics, no evolution. So we don't even we have a kind of spectroscopy. We don't know what's actually been radiated if we have decay from one level to another level. Right? There's no dynamics relating different levels in the spectroscopy. So, but with the help of this research, we might be able to apply it to solve the dynamical problems, because we have evolution moves of the spin network, and these evolution moves makes the braid excitations propagate from one point to another point on the graph on the spin network, and some of the braid excitations, they can even interact with each other. So this may be applied to this project of Mohammed. So this is a kind of quick application we could think about. And yeah, so here's some fun I made in loops of seven. So what does Neil Armstrong say when he first time set foot on the moon? I heard that there are two versions, actually. One bad version, one good version. So I of course refer to the good version, right? But I'm not, you know, I don't think it's very, it might be very arrogant to say that from my mouth. So you can think about it. Yeah, so acknowledgement. So thanks for organizers, including myself, of the conference. So make this possible.
We have a couple minutes for questions, so just
I have a quick question. What about photon?
Is photon representation? Well, in some sense model, photon could be considered for actually all those Higgs bosons can be considered as trivial braids, means braids without bosons.
So you don't have to consider bosons.
Yeah, so far we, like what I said, we don't actually have a direct physical correspondence.
Yeah. Then those braids with trivial crossings, they can then propagate, therefore left and drawn up and jacked on propagating on.
Yeah. You can go to
the that's the thing with integers in the details.
Yeah. They're not.
Do you know how, sorry, it's just not, how do you want to make, how do you make a connection to the synthesis? I don't understand. How would you go about doing that?
Well, just for example, we, like what I answered to their question, for example, the trigger brain may be considered as a gauge boson, right? So, and those non-trivial braids with that are chiral, and they can be considered as a chiral fermion. This is, and you can see the charges in the, all these quantum numbers.
You have to take the four-point vertex with four extra lines, and you split it into two three-point vertices, with a single line in between them.
No, the point is that Sundance's game was happened to be embedded first into four-valent, into three-valent spin networks, but there's no real, it's not necessarily a convention. His original paper is not three-valent graphs.
No, I guess what Sean asked is just a kind of more general question. How do you compare this to a standard model?
Yeah.
It's not
really a lot of work. Do a lot more work and understand whether the classifications that Sundance described are at all relevant. For example, whether the irreducible braids are the same as we map up to the irreducible braids in Sundance.
But one advantage in the forum case is that
there are not so many braids that can interact and propagate. So this kind of maybe solve the kind of the major problem of the interpreting particles as a topological invariance.
Any other questions? No? Okay, so then let's thank you.